especially to maintain the supply in the space environment. So we simply buried the helium tank. The small tank that you saw earlier is now buried in this larger tank. That was a major configuration change. One of the other things we came up against was the fact that as a part of this adding the spin system, we found that the energy balance was not proper between the oxidizer and fuel turbo pumps. And we suffered some difficulties in getting the engine started as a result of that. So we added this system, which we call the oxidizer turbine bypass system. And it has a valve in it that is in one position for start and helps your spin energy, and in another position for main station. It's part of the engine calibration feature. Okay, we built engines then. These were the early R&D changes before we ever produced an engine to go to the customer. We built engines in roughly four blocks as we went down through our production run. The first 12 engines, 2001 through 2011, were what we called our ground test engines. They were simply to demonstrate the feasibility. They were not designed for flight. They had many deficiencies that would not have been allowable for subsequent flight engines. And they had many problems, as you might anticipate from the early engine standpoint. They were produced relatively early on in the scheme of things, and there were very limited number of R&D engines that had been previously run. So they were, in effect, almost R&D engines, although they were produced and delivered to the customer for his demonstration purposes. 2012 was the real first production-type engine. It had several changes from prior engines. We bleed the J2 engine. The propellants are bled into an overboard situation, which doesn't show here very nicely. But both the LOX and fuel go through bleed valves back into the stage and are then either recirculated or dumped overboard, depending on your desires. The bleed system had been a 1-inch system. We increased it to 1.5-inch diameter. The gas generator, which is kind of hard to see, but it's this little pot down in here, had been a bolt-on. There had been a flanged connection to the turbo pump, the fuel turbo pump. In the early prior engines, it became a weld-on. It was an integral part. The gas generator body became an integral part of the fuel turbine manifold. We made some changes in timing. The electrical control assembly here on the engine controls virtually all the engine functions. You just send it a start signal and a stop signal, and everything else is pretty much automatic. So it contains engine logic and timers and so forth. We changed some of those. And the pneumatic system, which has its helium bottle within this tank and a regulator over in here, which uses the gas from the helium bottle, we added a redundant feature to it. We utilized one of these cans, an instrumentation can over here, to become an accumulator. Thereby, if something happened over here that caused helium to cease to flow to the engine while it was in main stage and operating, it has an accumulator volume that it will continue to operate off of and provide gas to the system throughout the remainder of the flight, thereby preventing a premature shutdown. So this feature was added at the 2012 point. At 2020, we made a real, significant production change point regarding the derivative engines that had gone to this point, and it was 2020 and subs that really became most of the man-rated flight-type engines. Several things we'd done. We had found that the uninsulated start tank was not satisfactory, so we added insulation to the start tank. We improved the performance of the engine by adding a different thrust chamber injector. The main injector is a bolt-in, and we changed that configuration slightly to improve the performance. We made some changes in the electrical control assembly in the interests of reliability. We went from gold-plated circuit boards to solder-plated boards. And one of the things that had come out of many space studies was that there was a potential temperature environment study, so we painted the thrust chamber white. We subsequently found out that was all wrong, so we took the white paint off at 2038, but at the time, we thought that was the right way to go. Since engine 2020 and subs were going to be tested on various stages around the country, we added what we called stage static instrumentation. A number of instrumentation lines which came from portions of the engine that were additional measurements in addition to the flight measurements, were desired for ground test in the various stages. One of the safety features of the engine is that it it looks at itself early during the main stage period and determines whether or not it should continue to run. It's done by monitoring a pressure. We had main stage okay pressure switch in the early design.
One more package.
We added a redundant pressure switch, so it's now there was now it now became a two pressure switch system, and thereby caused the start to be even more reliable. Just the failure of a single switch would not terminate it any further. And finally, at the 2020 point, we went from just relatively good but not terribly protected electrical harnesses.
They're
not shown here, but a number of electrical cables come from here and go virtually all over the engine from this electrical control assembly. We went to what we called our armored harnesses at that point. These are harnesses that can withstand elevated temperatures for a significant period of time, 1500 degrees for 30 seconds. It's pretty much within their capability and still not degrade the reliability of them. Okay, we went along that way then until we got to 2060. And 2060 was the earliest point in time we could implement what we called our 230K engine. The initial engines had been calibrated to run at 225,000 pounds. And vehicle definition had requested an increase in thrust of 5,000 pounds to support heavier payloads as we got going. In order to operate the engine reliably and make it a man-rated engine at 230,000 pounds, we did several things. Basically, in the turbo machinery area, the rest of the engine design was relatively amenable to being just up to the slight increase in pressures. But the turbopumps did require some relatively major work, beefing up of the turbine components primarily to withstand the higher speeds and so forth. So both the turbopumps had rather significant detail improvements for the 2060 and subsequent engines. In addition, some of our early flight experience had convinced us that the ground test simulation of the engine start transient was not entirely sufficient to understand how the engine was going to start at altitude. We went. We had some near misses. We never caused one to fail to start at altitude, but we scared ourselves pretty good on some of the early flights. And as a consequence, we improved the portion of the pneumatic hydraulic in this respect being oxidizer control features of the engine. Suffice to say that in the early engines, the main oxidizer valve located here. Come out of the oxidizer pump and into the main oxidizer valve. It's a butterfly type valve, pretty much an ordinary valve. The entire engine is pneumatic controlled, so it's a pneumatic controlled valve. And in order for the engine to start properly, it's necessary that it ramp rather slowly from an intermediate position of about 14 degrees open to its full open position. When I say slowly, I mean over almost 2 seconds. Getting a valve that is pneumatically controlled to do that, if you're familiar with the characteristics of butterfly valves, flow forces on them tend to close them at intermediate positions, usually up to about half open. And we were controlling this valve pneumatically by venting the actuator rather than by trying to pressurize it. So we jammed the pressure to the opening side and controlled the opening of the valve by venting the closing side of the actuator. This was highly sensitive to the temperature of the gas and the temperature of the valve that was being vented. And the space environment was causing us to see colder temperatures than we had anticipated. And the net result was sort of a closed loop system that was not particularly beneficial to the engine. The problem being, as you tried to vent down the valve, if you didn't vent it out fast enough, then you would build up flow forces. And as you build up flow forces, you would make the situation worse because you would be increasing the pressure between the turbopump and this valve, which in turn fed the gas generator. And it would feed the gas generator then ever higher pressure liquid oxygen, which would tend to drive the gas generator to higher levels, both temperature and pressure, which would in turn tend to produce more liquid oxygen head pressure, which would tend to jam the main oxidizer valve closed.
Well, with all kinds of valves available, why did you stick to a butterfly? Was it because in its normal operation this was more desirable?
Yeah, it was a more desirable, simple, reliable valve, derivative of our prior programs with no problems. Mm-hmm. We only got into the problem, I think, because of the necessity for building the engine up relatively slowly. The solution implemented was not to go to an entirely new type valve, although we did, of course, consider that. We evolved to something called a thermostatic control orifice within the valve. In other words, you can devise, and we are flying, an orifice situation which is insensitive to temperature. This is a series of pintles that are temperature sensitive that move within orifices, and they sense the temperature and neatly regulate the flow of gas out of the valve to be insensitive to this temperature condition, and thereby allowing us to start the engine very nicely. It was a relatively small change to a part that had demonstrated good reliability in main stage and so forth.
Were these valves fairly new hardware items? Did you develop them? Were they on-the-shelf hardware?
No, we had to develop the thermostatic orifice ourselves. Our control people developed that. And we tested it at Arnold Development Center in Tullahoma rather extensively, as well as on sea level tests at our facilities. We did incorporate it into the 2060 engines, and we'll back incorporate it, presumed to put it back into the 200 series flights that have engines prior to 2060 on them, which I believe is 206 and 7.
Mm-hmm.
In any event, it was an eminently successful fix to the problem. It got us out of any really detailed control system mod or valve mod at a point in time when that would have been very difficult to implement and qualify. Okay, those were the changes at the 2060 point. At 2140, we did begin to eliminate some of the excessive instrumentation bosses and so forth that were no longer required. And that was essentially the only really major changes that we saw in the latter part of the production program, which ran up through 2152. During the scope of the program, we did retrofit some of the engines. Because of engine stage problems, the S2 oxidizer system, as you're aware, the S2 does not have recirculation pumps on the oxidizer side. They use a thermal cycled system. It was necessary to insulate the oxidizer, a number of the oxidizer components, bleed lines and so forth on the engine in order to promote adequate cooling there. We have added insulation to the ECA can for some of the flight applications, and we have insulated the fuel bleed lines on both the S2 and the S4B to allow them better efficiency on their recirc systems. Those are kind of the major changes, I guess, that we see. If you'd like, this just goes through the chronology.
Yeah,
right. Certainly want to have a copy of that. Are there any questions that I can attempt to answer?
Who has control of the recirc system? You or the contractor?
Contractor has control of the recirc system. He has the recirc pumps.
Yeah.
We simply supply an interface point at our fluid customer connect, where we send back to him the fluid that has been pumped through the engine. In the case of the oxidizer system, the bleed point is very close to the main oxidizer valve. Indeed, this valve here is the bleed valve. This valve here is the bleed valve. It also goes over and supplies the gas generator oxidizer. So it's tapped off right there.
Mm-hmm.
Now this goes back into a customer connect fluid point over here.
Mm-hmm.
And the vehicle picks up these customer connect points and does with them as they wish. For example, if you wish to just dump it overboard, you could. Of course, for propellant management, you do not. Both S2 and S4B have returned to the main tank. In the case of the S4B, there is a recirc pump located in the tank. Actually, the way they do this is they close the main propellant valve in the tank. It gets closed, and then the recirc is a bypass around that. So it gets to cycle around that, sends it back. Sends it down into our oxidizer pump, up through the duct here, chills that system, and then bleeds overboard. The fuel bleed valve is located here, so you see it does not chill this last little bit down to the thrust chamber, which remains at relatively normal temperatures. It likewise feeds through the bleed valve to the gas generator, and the bleed valve has an outlet line, not on this model, it goes over to the fluid customer plant. In the case of both the S2 and the S4B, in tank around the main propellant valve, main tank propellant valves, research systems are provided with the most.
Now, do you tell these people how to go about doing that, or is that their own problem?
Well, no, there's an interface document that defines the requirements of the engine and the stage with respect to each other. And early on in the program, this was defined as to what the flow rates would be and the chilling intervals and so forth. Through iteration, this has become a relatively routine situation.
But do you give these successes, you deliver this to the government, do you give all this to the government, and the government's hassle with the North American?
No. There were a number, I believe, a number of rather significant hassles on interface down through the years. Mm-hmm. But in general, the government has acted basically to provide their good offices to let the contractors solve the problems. Mm-hmm. If we have had a problem, I don't know whether that's true for the F1 or not, Joe, but I think it's pretty much true for the J2. If we've had a problem with the S4B stage, it's been pretty much up to us at McDonnell Douglas to resolve. It's been especially true in the S2 stage, where indeed the two warring parties were part of the same company. Mm-hmm. The government has rather frequently taken the position that, hey, would you guys in your silly company please get everything under control?
Early in the program, when most of the interface problems existed or were being hashed out, there were several meetings set up by NASA where all the contractors that were affected in these different interfaces would get together in large meetings and go through them. So, needless to say, any one or any two parties can't necessarily work out all of the details on this thing. There are several areas of concern when you start interfacing, just the engine to the stage. You also have to concern yourself with all the ground equipment interfaces, electrical interfaces, guidance control systems, and things of that nature. So all of the contractors generally got together. And in the case of the F1 program, we must have had at least somewhere in the neighborhood of 12, so thank you. We probably had in the neighborhood of 12 or 15 formal meetings to establish all of these interface requirements. And then in between these meetings, then we also have smaller discussions and splinter meetings and things of that nature. So at this point in the program, where most of these problems are resolved, there's only minor changes that come up nowadays. Now we generally just handle them as they come up. But at that time, there were formal meetings established to handle the interfacing requirements.
Now, the government is a broker between contractors to get these interfacing?
Yeah. Yes. For instance, we're only on contract with NASA. Mm-hmm. We are not subordinate contractors to the stage manufacturers. Mm-hmm. So consequently, being on contract strictly with NASA, that's who our prime responsibility lies with. So we deal through the NASA people and interfacing with the stage people.
Do you think it might have been better to, like in program management from Marshall's point of view, when Arthur Rudolph had the responsibility for all of Saturn, but he didn't have the engines, Lee Ballou had the engines. And so, you know, he could do the whole stage, but he still had to, you know, work back through you people to find out what was going on in the engines, you think?
Within the NASA organization.
Complex? Made for complexity?
I don't know, it may or may not. I can see why within NASA they had to split it up also. Mm-hmm. And consequently, they have to interface amongst themselves. It's mm-hmm. still like that. All of the engine programs are handled by one program management organization within mm-hmm. NASA, Marshall, mm-hmm. and the stage offices are separate. And so consequently, they have to interface amongst themselves also.
Did that organization create any problems? Because I understand that sometimes they didn't even know what the engine office would be giving directions to Rocketdyne, and then Rocketdyne would send back, say, whatever, you know, here are the drawings.
Along that line, I would sort of suspect that the early days were the worst. Mm-hmm. We were defining engines and defining stages. And it's certainly true in my case, and kind of true in Joe's case, that we weren't strongly involved in the decision-making process at that point in time. We were both doing basically engineering work. Some of the folks that Paul Fuller and Bob Montaigne mentioned earlier, Paul Fuller would be an excellent one to talk to on that with respect to the J2. Some of the early F1 people that were in the program management. So that would be less an engineering problem than it would be a program management problem. The engineer would just get frustrated. The program manager is the one who's got to resolve it. I was, at that point in time, I was basically connected with the thrust chamber assembly. So I didn't feel its frustrations particularly. I think there was probably a lot of frustration. Whether there's a better way, whether there was a way that would have been obvious to a Paul Fuller or a Willie Wilhelm, I don't know.
There were a lot of problems, needless to say, and it took a lot of agreements and working relationships and what have you to iron these things out.
I think it
everybody commented on, including the NASA people. With time, they just worked these things all out, established working arrangements and working agreements on who was responsible for what had interface where. Spent a lot of time just establishing procedures and requirements for when a given contractor submits a document, say an engineering change proposal to make a design change, and it had any impact on the interface or the operation of the engine, say if it was a stage contractor. We made arrangements through NASA, and they agreed that we would get a copy of those documents, and then we have to review them and formally send back an answer to NASA indicating whether that has an impact on the engine. If it does, what is the impact or what suggestions do we have? Similarly, they do the same thing with any of our changes. We have to send a copy of every change to NASA, and then if it impacts the stage, they send that to the stage contractor. So these kind of agreements had to be established, and they were. It took some time, naturally, to work these things out.
The whole system works pretty well now.
Communications net just to keep everybody informed. Needless to say, the more people involved, the more complicated it gets. There's a lot of companies involved, a lot of people, a lot of NASA organizations within their own structure.
Now, do you have responsibility for all the equipment that's loaded to the thrust chamber, the S2 and S4B, all those little boxes and what have you? Is that part of your equipment?
As you see it here, we have a responsibility for that. The gimbal actuators are stage equipment, and we don't have any responsibility for that. The oxidizer turbopump down at the bottom has an access port for a hydraulic pump. That's a stage piece of stage gear. We don't have any responsibility for that. Virtually all of the flight instrumentation is supplied by us through we have instrumentation packages on the engine. And we make the measurements that are required and send them through our electrical interface to the stage where they're modulated and transmitted. The stage doesn't hang too much stuff on us. The insulation that is hung on the engine is Rocket Man's responsibility. That's about the size of it, I guess. They don't hang an awful lot of stuff on us. Special measurements. We may come to an interface point and allow them to screw something in to a tap. But that's relatively rare now.
Similar to the F1, I think the Boeing company does install some temperature and heat radiation measurements on the engine. And the only requirement we had there was to provide a pad to mount the transducer and the lead wire and what have you. So that was, again, worked out in these interface requirements. Yeah, they also provide the gimbal actuation system. We provide a boss on the fuel high pressure duct, which they tap off high pressure fuel to operate the gimbal system with. And similarly, we have a boss on the return system to return the fluid flow from the gimbal system back to the engine. So we're providing the fluid power, but they provide the mechanical system to do the job. So you get into those kind of interfaces.
Those points are always in our as to who makes the gimbal system and who makes the hydraulic pumps and so forth. Rocketdyne was of course on contract to demonstrate gimbling of the engine, so we made our own gimbal system to demonstrate the gimbling of the engine, that the engines would withstand the forces and have the capability of operating. But it's probably just as effective and just as neat to have the stage responsible for that too. Certainly the guidance is going to be theirs. And there is a logic, I think, that suggests that everything involved in guidance should be one person's or another.
I think it was strictly NASA's prerogative to decide who was going to provide what equipment. We initially in the F1 attempted to sell them both the inlet ducting to the engine, which has to flex when the engine wiggles, as well as the gimbal system. But they elected in both cases to provide that to the stage contractor for responsibility rather than to Rocket Man.
One of the more interesting questions of whose responsibility is it has to be the POGO situation that occurred on both the S1C and the S2. In both cases, we're talking about engine stage feed system coupled instabilities, which you could not indict any single member of the loop, but you could define the loop, you could affect solutions. In the case of both cases, the solutions were kind of hybrids, fish or fowl, basically. Accommodated the problem by changing the system gain and therefore breaking the loop.
Yeah, now how did the accumulator get on the fifth engine in the recent flight?
All right. It was a good case where NASA recognized a problem. They established a POGO working group. Previously, actually, as a result of an S1C problem, the POGO working group was pretty much already in existence. The POGO working group worked with a number of contracting agencies. Rocketdyne was dominant in supplying engine gains and impedances, as well as a heavy contributor to the feed system, gains and impedances, which involved not only these flexible ducts here, but the stage ducting as well. The Space Division folks were dominant in supplying information to define the stage mode shapes and characteristics. But the government engaged Belcom and the Boeing Company to help them with the analyses which were being performed both by Rocketdyne and SD. Rocketdyne developed its own model of the whole thing. SD developed its own model of the whole thing as far as an analytical model is concerned. Boeing and Belcom did likewise, and the POGO working group at Huntsville did likewise. The net result of all of this was that we were able to define the problem to each other's satisfaction. Well, everybody's model was a little bit different. And the accumulator looked like an attractive solution to the problem. The accumulator was actually about the third solution to the problem. The first solution had been that it's not a problem, and we've noted it, and we don't think it'll ever. We don't think it's a POGO loop. We don't think it'll ever diverge. Then the amplitude spectrator on subsequent flights, and we were concerned, so we shut the center engine off early because the amplitude seemed to be largest toward the end of burn. And then on the 508 flight, the amplitudes got very large. It diverged very rapidly, and it was the engine pressure switches, which I mentioned during the run-through on the engine configuration, that shut the engine down and saved the stage because the next cycle, it's very likely to have destroyed the stage. The engine responded to the high level of oscillation and ceased in engine operation on number 5. The accumulator was a solution which had been previously developed by Space Division and was there on the shelf waiting, ready to go. So it got put in. See, these on the center engine, these ducts do not exist. Since the center engine is not a gimbalable engine, these ducts are removed and the stage ducting comes straight in. It's a relatively short gain loop as far as physically, since the bottom of the sump on the S2 sits right above the engine. It just come out straight into the oxygen pump. It was a good case in point of the government acting both actively and passively, setting up the organization, and their organization staying on top of the problem. And that result was a design certification board meeting in Washington shortly before the flight that allowed us how the accumulator was a reasonable solution to the problem. The data from the flight certainly seems to indicate all of the analysis that was done. It's by far and away the smoothest flight from the standpoint of 17 Hertz POGO that we've ever seen.
Still talking about oscillation characteristics. Did you give me oscillation characteristics when you fired 5 clustered engines for the first time at Santa Susana?
Nothing of significance. There was a lot of concern about it. There was concern as to the total noise level.